So much. There's just such a good congregation, such great Christians that are here. You think about their stand for the truth and what it has meant down through the years, and I just appreciate them. And I have been given dating, courtship, and marriage. I don't know why I was given that topic. Maybe it's because I have some teenage boys that will be dating soon. I suspect that they probably thought, they looked at me and they looked at my wife, and they said, well, if Russell could win the hand of such a beautiful, lovely Christian as Dee, he must know something about dating, courtship, and marriage. I am blessed. We're going to be in Ecclesiastes chapter 12. You can turn there. You know, the days of our youth should be a time of great joy. But sadly, the innocence and the purity of our young people is often destroyed by the lenient ideas of our society concerning dating, courtship, and marriage. It's at that young age where things can become so dangerous if they don't find that right path in life. Now, there is that idea out there that you should just wait until you're older and then seek God, then seek righteousness. But that's not what the Bible says. They will tell you today that, well, when you're young, that's when you should experience life. And by that, what they really mean is experience sin. And that's simply not the case. In Ecclesiastes 12 and verse 1, notice this verse. Remember now thy Creator in the days of thy youth, while the evil days come not, nor the years draw nigh, when thou shalt say, I have no pleasure in them. When are we to remember our Creator? Now. Now. And notice, even for emphasis on that, remember him now, in thy youth, while the evil days come not, nor the years draw nigh. That's talking about old age. The evil days, they're evil in the sense that you have to deal with affliction and disease. And he even goes on to say, when thou shalt say, I have no pleasure in them. When you get older and you lose those sharp senses, perhaps you don't see as well or hear as well and your voice is not as strong. Don't wait till then. Remember now thy Creator in the days of thy youth. You see, who you decide to marry is the second most important decision of this life, second only to your obedience to the gospel. Look at an Old Testament passage, 2 Chronicles chapter 21. You know, in the Old Testament, we find the record of the kings. Now, remember the divided kingdom? You had the kings of Israel and the kings of Judah. The kings of Israel, they were all evil. Every one of them. There wasn't a good one in the bunch. The kings of Judah, they had a few good kings, but for the most part, they were evil as well. But we're going to talk about one of those kings who was evil, and we're going to see why he was evil, and I think you'll see how it fits into our topic. Boy, I got my second win just then. 2 Chronicles 21, starting with verse 5, Jehoram, he was the fifth king of Judah. It says, Jehoram was 32 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 8 years in Jerusalem. And look at verse 6. And he walked in the ways of the kings of Israel, like as did the house of Ahab. Now you remember Ahab. He was the eighth king of Israel. In 1 Kings 16 and verse 33, it says, he did more to provoke the Lord God to anger than all the kings that were before him. And this says, Jehoram walked in his way. He was evil like him. Well, why? Look at the rest of that verse. It says, for he had the daughter of Ahab to wife, and he wrought that which was evil in the eyes of the Lord. He made a poor choice concerning his bride. And you see that evil influence there. Therefore, since who we marry is so important, we must approach the subject of dating with all seriousness. Dating is a precursor to marriage and family and the home. Think about it. The person you marry is going to be somebody that you've dated. So in this lesson, we're going to look at that process, dating, courtship, and marriage. Now, dating and courtship, those terms are sometimes used interchangeably, but they're not the same thing. Dating is defined as the act of engaging in social activities with one of the opposite sex. In other words, you go out for a movie, go out to eat, dating. Whereas courtship is defined as the process by which one attempts to win the hand of the one that they desire to marry. You see how the progression takes place. Let's start with dating. Have you noticed that the age of those who are starting to date has become increasingly younger and younger? Those who are not old enough and mature enough to make good, wise decisions are given the freedom to go out on a date whenever and wherever they want. And often there's no supervision, no guidance from the parents. Now that's not what God intended. God requires the parents to have an active role and an involvement in their children's lives. Ephesians 6 and verse 4 says, "And ye fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord." Parents, we have to motivate our children to follow the teachings of the Bible. It is to guide them in all that they do in this life, and that includes dating. I think too many parents are more concerned that their children are popular than righteous. I heard of a woman who was talking about her daughter. And she did understand that cheerleading was wrong because of the suggestive movements, because of the immodesty. But she was going to let her daughter be a cheerleader anyway because she wanted her to be popular. Do we not understand? The days of our youth should be a time of righteousness. Parents, have we forgotten that dating can be a time that produces great temptations? Have we warned our children about that? Or do we feel uncomfortable talking about such things? They need to know. Improper physical contact leads to lasciviousness, and lasciviousness leads to fornication. 1 Corinthians 6 and verse 18 says, "Flee fornication. Every sin that a man doeth is without the body, but he that committeth fornication sinneth against his own body." Something else. While dating, time alone together should be limited. Some are tempted to do things that they should not when they are hidden from the watchful eyes of others. Let us impress on our children and upon ourselves that God sees all. Proverbs 15 and verse 3 says, "The eyes of the Lord are in every place, beholding the evil and the good." You know, while dating, good moral judgments often become clouded by feelings of desire. And our sexually explicit culture has not helped in this area. Do you see the things that are going on? Did you see the halftime show at the Super Bowl? These pornographic images are paraded before the eyes of our youth at every turn. And with these images comes a weakening of self-control. William Stanmeyer wrote in his book called Clear and Present Danger, he wrote these words about pornography. He said, "Though crude, pornography is a philosophical statement. It says there are not rules about sex. Sex is trivial. Sex is for entertainment. Though debased, he says, pornography is a theological statement. It says there is no God who says I should limit my lust or channel my passions or give as well as get. Pornography is anti-woman, he says, anti-child. It is anti-marriage and anti-permanence. Thus, it is profoundly anti-civilization. He says, since civilization is the social support to the dynamics of life, pornography is anti-life." Amen. That's the problem. It has been proven that gazing upon pornographic images creates a desire to act upon them. We must emphasize to our children that premarital sexual relations are forbidden by God. You know, purity may be mocked by the world, but those teens who desire God's approval, they will live lives of chastity and self-control. 1 Thessalonians 4 and verse 7 says, "For God hath not called us unto uncleanness, but unto holiness." The word holiness there means separated from sin, sanctified, set apart for God. Do you remember Jacob and Esau? Esau sold his birthright for a bowl of stew in Genesis chapter 25. In a time of weakness, he foolishly traded something of great value to fulfill his momentary desire. And I fear that many young people have made a similar mistake when they surrendered to their desires in a parked car on a lonely road. Purity must be seen for its true value. Esau would have never sold his birthright if he would have realized its worth. The price to pay for fornication is steep. It is a sin that, though repented of, it can have severe consequences. Whether we're talking about a bad reputation or guilt, unwanted pregnancy, AIDS, and our other sexually transmitted diseases. And even if you escape those, how are you going to feel when you have to look in the eyes of the young man or woman that you would like to marry and you have to tell them that you did not save yourself for them? You know, they may not want to marry you when they learn about your past. And girls, if you are thinking, "Well, it's okay for me to sleep with my boyfriend because he's going to marry me," let me tell you this. There was a study done at a Midwestern school, and it showed indeed that 80% of the girls there, they planned to marry the person they were having sexual relations with. But only 12% of the men had any desire to marry that person. You see, it's wrong. And that kind of thinking is wrong. 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 2 makes it clear. Another temptation that must be faced during the dating years is that of entertainment. The Christian is often asked to go places and do things they simply should not do. Whether we're talking about dancing, clubs, parking, immoral movies. Dating activities must be chosen carefully. And there is a wealth of good activities to do. A wealth of things out there that are wholesome and righteous. But you have to look for them. You have to make the effort to do those things that please God. You know, I think some never really understand the purpose of dating. They believe that the purpose of dating is to have fun. And it is fun, but that's not its purpose. The purpose of dating is to find a suitable candidate for marriage. Now, that may seem cold and calculating, but that's true. Our young people should be encouraged early on to take a more analytical approach in their dating. And parents, if we wait until they're already infatuated with someone and then try to tell them, "Slow down, think about it," it's not going to work. Have you ever seen two young people who are in love, quote unquote? It's as if their brain has disconnected. Try to reason with these people. It doesn't work. Why do you think we have such expressions as falling in love? Or that love is blind? It's too late then to talk to them about going slow. The young woman should ask herself, "Will he be a good husband? A good father?" The young man should consider, "Will she be a good wife and a good mother?" You see, in dating, the search is not simply for one who is fun to be with, but for one who is going to help you get to heaven. You see, that's the whole purpose of the marriage relationship. That's what God intended. Two coming together and becoming one, helping each other to heaven. Genesis 2 and verse 18, the Lord God said, "It is not good that the man should be alone. I will make him an helpmeet for him." Helpmeet, two words, a helper suited that here is the woman, she is suited to the man. Husband and wife, the man suited for the woman, husband and wife, they become one. They're going to help each other. How? In all aspects of life, but especially spiritually. They're going to help each other grow closer to God. So you say, okay, Russell, how should I decide who I'm going to date? There's a lot out there. How do you make a choice? Who do you go out with? Who do you not go out with? Well, let's set up an elimination process. First, ask yourself a question. What is this person's attitude towards God? Now, if this person does not believe in God, does not respect God, has no reverence for God, guess what? Eliminate them. There's no reason to date that person. You're not going to help yourself in any way. And ask yourself a second question. Is this person a faithful Christian? If they claim to be a Christian, but you can tell by their life that they are not spiritually minded, they don't care about religious things, eliminate them from your list. There's someone you don't need to date. You know, those two qualities, their attitude toward God, their faithfulness to Christ, that should form your attraction to them. Now, you may be thinking that, well, that doesn't sound like attraction. The way our young people think about attraction, they're thinking, well, is she beautiful or is he handsome? They're thinking in those physical terms. And I understand that appearance is going to play a part. That's the first thing we notice. I know that. But love at first sight is often wrong. We must not allow the good looks of another to blind us to more meaningful things. I know my good looks did not blind my wife's ability to see my other qualities, like humility. You know, even in the area of appearance, there are things to consider here. How do they present themselves to the world? Have you seen some of these young people? Now, the young men, it'll be in the middle of the summer and they'll have that toboggan on, you know, because that's real cool. They'll have that NBA jersey. It'll be on backwards. And I guess the stores don't sell belts anymore. I guess you can't find those because all their jeans keep going lower and lower. And what about the young women? I don't know what they're looking for. I'm thinking where they're shopping, they must have a new line of clothing called Rahab wear. Think about it. Because they wear those shirts that are barely shirts. They're so short, they show their belly button. That's something that's real popular now. You want to show your belly button. And then they wear short shorts. And as if that's not bad enough, they put words on the back of their shorts, like cheer or volleyball, just to make sure that people's eyes go to where they're not supposed to be. Now, what's going on? And young people, don't bring somebody home to meet your parents. This boyfriend of yours that's covered in tattoos, got piercings everywhere, don't bring him home and expect your parents to be overjoyed to see this guy come down the walk. How do they present themselves to the world? Finding one who is attractive, that will motivate us, but it is those internal characteristics that are truly important. Is this person beautiful on the inside? 1 Peter 3, verses 3 through 4. And there are other things to consider as well. What about their personality? Now, some are quick to say that opposites attract. They say that if you're quiet and shy, you need to find somebody who's loud and outgoing. Okay, maybe opposites attract. But it can also be a problem in the long run. Consider that. And also, what about the ability to communicate with this person? Are you able to talk to them? Can you confide in them and still feel secure? Do you trust them? You know, if you cannot communicate with this person, any future marriage you have will be a failure. Marriage must have communication. And also, think about the things that you don't like about this person. Now, when we're dating, we overlook those things. We need to think about it. It's only natural. We're all different. We all have our idiosyncrasies. All those little things that annoy us, our pet peeves. You know what my wife's pet peeve is? It's the phrase, pet peeve. Now, how do you argue with logic like that? Welcome to my world. But we all have those things. People are different. Some little thing may really bother you. And if it does, ask yourself, can I live with this person for 40, 50, 60, 70 years? Those little annoyances can become quite maddening after a time. There was a speaker at a woman's club who was giving a lecture on marriage, talking a lot about the things that we are saying now. And she asked her audience of these women, how many of you want to mother your husbands? And a lady actually raised her hand in the back, and that kind of surprised the speaker. And she asked her, you want to mother your husband? And she said, mother? I thought you said smother. See, those little things won't seem so little as the years go on. And if you're thinking that after your marriage ceremony you're going to change those things, good luck with that. Let me know how that goes. Doesn't work, does it? Do you understand that when you're dating that person, you're seeing them at their best? I mean, they're all cleaned up. They've got their nice clothes, using their best manners. They're at their best. Now, if something there is not right, don't think it's going to get better. Let's move on to the next step. Let's say that you've been dating now and you've found the one that you truly love. And you want to spend your life with this individual. You have to go to that next step, the courtship process. You know, in the Bible, that we often find that the choice of the bride was made by relatives or a friend of the groom. And that sometimes the father or the older brothers would decide who the girl was going to marry. What do you think about that, young people? You want your parents to decide who you're going to marry? Now, when I was young, I wouldn't want any part of that. But now that I'm a parent, I'm thinking, you know, it's not such a bad idea. We understand today things are different. In our culture, the choice of the bride or the groom depends solely upon that individual. And that has its obvious advantages. But have you ever thought that it also has its drawbacks? There is a certain degree of objectivity that is lost. Infatuation can cause a person to make a poor choice. You see, there's a difference between infatuation and true love. You say, okay, well, what is true love? Well, let me tell you this. It is not what is portrayed in television and in movies and in music. A well-known rock musician said this, and I quote, "It's hard to believe that the majority of teens today are so shallow-minded. Our songs are about lust, not love." You see, true love involves commitment. And I think sometimes our young people are missing that. There was a young man that went to the jeweler. He was going to buy a beautiful gold locket for his girlfriend. And the jeweler asked him, "Well, would you like for me to engrave her name on the locket?" And he paused and he thought about it and he said, "No, engrave on there to my one and true only love. And that way, if we break up, I can give it to somebody else." You see, they really don't understand. True love will keep a husband and wife committed to each other even through the difficult times. True love is not quick to give up and seek a solution from a divorce court. I read about a mother who received a telephone call from her recently married daughter, and it seems that these newlyweds had had their first big fight, and the mother was was trying to comfort her daughter and talk to her, but she soon became so emotional, she just had to hand the phone to the father and go to the other room. And so the dad, he talked to her for a while and then went back in to the mother. And she said, "What happened?" And the father explained, "Well, she said that she wanted to come home." And the mother said, "Well, what did you say?" He said, "I told her, you are home. You see, when you marry that person, that's your home. And you are committed to that home." Not only has our society rejected the permanence of marriage, it has also sought to justify living together before marriage. This has come to be accepted in our land and in some circles even expected. They say that it's helpful to the marriage. During the courtship process, you should live together and that will help. No, it won't. A matter of fact, the Journal of Marriage and Family reported that couples who live together before marriage are less satisfied with their marriages and more likely to break up when things become difficult. They think of it as a trial marriage. We'll live together and it'll be like a trial marriage. But you see, God's Word clearly condemns such nonsense and calls it for what it is, fornication. In 1 Corinthians 7, verses 1 and 2, Paul writes, "Now concerning the things whereof you wrote unto me, it is good for a man not to touch a woman." And notice verse 2, "Nevertheless, to avoid fornication, let every man have his own wife and every woman have her own husband." There is no doubt that there are many strong temptations that occur during the courtship process, and that's only natural. When you love someone so much, you have that desire to be close to them. But a line must be drawn. The sexual relationship is reserved for the marriage. Hebrews 13 and verse 4 says, "Marriage is honorable in all, and the bed undefiled. But whoremongers and adulterers God will judge." So who should you marry? First and foremost, you should marry a faithful Christian. A marriage that is divided religiously will not be all that God intended it to be. Divorce is such a huge problem in our society. And those marriages that are religiously divided, they face a greater risk for separation. And when you think about it honestly, they're already partially separated. You see, they don't have the same attitudes and goals and desires that exist when both partners are faithful Christians. And there is that temptation for the Christian to be drawn closer to their unbelieving spouse, which can pull them away from Christ. And yet there are so many advantages to the marriage of two faithful Christians. They enjoy a deeper sense of devotion and security, and both have the primary purpose of helping the other go to heaven. Both will appreciate the permanent bond of the marriage relationship. Now, I know the Bible does not specifically say thou shalt only marry a faithful Christian, but it does warn against being unequally yoked together with unbelievers in 2 Corinthians 6 and verse 14. Christians and non-Christians do not have the same standards, goals, and priorities in this life. Amos 3 and verse 3 asks the question, can two walk together except they be agreed? And I know you'll be able to tell me of some situation that someone who was a Christian married a non-Christian and they converted that person. What? That's great. I love that. But for every case you can show me like that, I can show you 100 where this non-Christian led that Christian astray and the Christian became unfaithful. Now, even when you do find a Christian, you still have to ask yourself some questions. Is this person completely committed to God? Have they submitted to God in all aspects of their life? You see, some claim to be Christians, but they do not completely follow the commandments of God. An outward show of spirituality without true devotion in the heart is not pleasing to God, and it should not be accepted by a prospective spouse. And men, you should ask yourselves, Does she have the qualities that are found in the description of the virtuous woman in Proverbs 31? Will she submit as the wife is commanded to submit to her husband in Ephesians 5, verses 22 and verse 33? Does she exhibit the qualities found in 1 Timothy 2, 9 through 15, and Titus 2, 4 through 5, qualities of modesty and godliness and subjection and soberness and love and discretion, a keeper of the home, obedient? And women, you need to ask yourselves, if the man that you would like to marry truly loves you as Christ loved the church and gave himself for it, Ephesians 5 and verse 25. Will he love you as his own flesh, Ephesians 5, 28 and 29? Will he honor you as taught in 1 Peter 3 and verse 7? Will he exhibit the qualities that are found in Titus 2 verses 6 and 7? Qualities of soberness, uncorruptness, gravity, sincerity. And both of you must make sure that your future spouse not only understands, but appreciates the permanent bond of the marriage relationship. Matthew 19, verses 4 through 9. You see, the marriage cannot be looked upon as an experiment. Once the vows are taken by the two scriptural candidates for marriage, they will be joined together for life. Recently, a man went to one of these modern wedding ceremonies. I don't know if you've heard about this. They're changing the vows. The traditional vows are not good enough for them. They're changing those. He was shocked when he heard the bride and the groom pledge, and I quote, to remain together as long as our love shall last. As long as our love shall last. So I guess when they have their first fight, they're going to go their separate ways. He decided to send to them as a wedding gift paper plates. I think that's fitting. We've got to hurry. Let's go on to marriage. When the wedding vows have been taken, they are for life. The marriage is binding, even if later you find out that you've made a terrible mistake. Marriage is not something, therefore, to be entered into lightly. And yet in our day, marriage is seen as a trivial thing by so many. Easy to get into, easy to get out of, means nothing to them. There's actually a ceremony that's taking place in Albuquerque, New Mexico. A company entitled Freedom Rings, the founder Lynn Peters, has this ceremony, and it's for those who want a divorce. They've devised this ceremony. And you pay your fee and take part in the ceremony. It comes complete with champagne and music. And then the one presiding over the ceremony says these words. They say, "We will now release any remaining ties to your past by transforming your rings, which represent the past, into a token of your new beginning." They say, "Stop for a moment to consider the transformation that is about to begin your new life. Ready? With this swing, let freedom ring." And at that point, this formerly married couple uses a 4-pound sledgehammer to smash their wedding rings into shapeless pieces of metal. What has become of respect for marriage? Marriage is for life, and you must make sure that you are truly ready for that commitment. A good marriage can be one of the greatest pleasures on this earth, but an unhappy marriage can be one of the most painful things to endure. Once the marriage takes place, there's going to be needed a time of adjustment. When two become one, it requires patience and understanding. Someone once said, "Marriage is when you agree to spend the rest of your life sleeping in a room that is too hot next to someone who is sleeping in a room that they think is too cold." You're going to need those adjustments. And most importantly, spiritually, both will need to make sure that they are performing their God-given duties. Sandra Humphreys wrote in her book, and she wrote a book about teens and dating, and I love the title of this book. It's entitled, "Don't Kiss Toads." She wrote in this book, and I quote, "The person you marry will have an indelible effect on your life. He or she will be the greatest factor in determining your way of life and consequently your eternal destiny. In our marriages, as we grow closer to each other, we must also grow closer to God. You see, in marriage, two lives are braided together. But do you know you can't braid two things? You can twist them, but they won't stay. You need that third strand. And that third strand is God. He has to be a part of that braiding together of the husband and the wife. In order to be successful in dating and courtship and marriage, we must keep Christ first and foremost. Set the goal early to marry a faithful Christian. Someone once said, make a list of the traits of the type of spouse that you would like to marry, then make a list of the traits that you would need to attract that type of a person. Then throw away the first list and work on the second. Don't just look for the right one, become the right one. I don't know about throwing away the first list. I think you ought to keep that just to make sure you're looking in the right way. But the point that is made is good. In order to attract the right kind of a person, you need to be the right kind of a person. Ask yourself this question. Is God a part of your plan for dating and courtship and marriage? Thank you.